mine who were in the path of the totality and witnessed day become night used words like intimacy, envelopment, joy, awe, and humility to describe the experience. It's that last word, humility, that stands out for me. Mainly because I have long doubted that I really understand what humility is. The image that comes to mind when I think about humility is someone kowtowing to someone else. And usually in this image, they're wearing some sort of monk's garb, which tells you something about how we tend to think about humility in the West. Humility means meekness, and well, we don't really do meekness in America, do we? The second thing that comes to mind for me is the opposite of humility, arrogance. Earlier this year, the rapper Ja Rule and a stock trader friend of his decided to launch a high-priced music festival on a tropical island, despite the fact they lacked one iota of knowledge about how to do this. When the festival failed miserably, the comedian Trevor Noah suggested that at the very least, the organizers should be praised for taking a risk and stepping outside their comfort zone. But as Noah's colleague Neil Brennan jokingly pointed out, maybe that's what's wrong with this country. Too many people believing in themselves. It's a small leap, after all, from confidence to arrogance. But I have long sensed humility goes deeper than meekness, that there's more to it than a mere lack of arrogance. I sensed humility must somehow be related to love and forgiveness and even activism and righteousness. But I wasn't sure how. These were questions I didn't have answers to. I needed to learn more from the experts. Fortunately, talking to experts is what I do for a living. As a science writer, I interview roboticists and biologists and digital archaeologists, so cool, about the work that they do and how it will change the world. And if that sounds like the best job ever, then that's because it is. But it turns out the answers I was seeking about the importance of humility didn't come from any one of these brilliant minds, but from the nature of my work itself. I've come to realize that my job is the best job ever because it requires me almost every day to humble myself before others. When I walk into a researcher's office, there's a good chance she's been an expert in the field for upwards of 20 years, whereas I only just heard about the field itself 5 minutes ago. For an hour or so, I hold on tightly to what she tells me, listening as hard as I can, asking the best questions I can muster to try to distill the essence of what is being said. I say over and over again, tell me more. Tell me more about that. Tell me more. Why then does it feel so natural for me to listen deeply about the microbiome or autonomous underwater vehicles, but not about what a random Trump supporter thinks about the border wall? In fact, I think that is precisely the least likely scenario in which I could see myself compelled to say, tell me more. The essayist Paul Graham writes that discussion of politics, like religion, tends to uniquely descend into useless arguing because, quote, people don't feel that they need to have any particular expertise to have opinions about it. Maybe that's the difference then. I defer to the expertise of scientists and engineers, and I'm sure a lot of you are happy to know that some people still do that, because they earned the expertise. But what's more, I can't often contribute much to these discussions, even when I want to. It's the scientist's story to tell. And I have humility enough to realize when I'm not the expert in the room. They know what's true, and I don't. Discussion of religion and politics, on the other hand, are based not on fact, but on identity. These discussions hinge on the stories we tell ourselves about who we are and how we think the world works. We are, in other words, experts on nothing more than our own opinions. Even those among us who take pride in sticking to the facts at all times must realize that that's virtually impossible with religion, and increasingly difficult with politics. Maybe there's something to Anne Truitt's statement that humility is really more natural than pride, which always seems to involve a lie. So what would happen if we started sitting down and listening to people's stories as if they truly were the experts? really listened to them and said to them again and again, tell me more about your thoughts on race in the United States. Tell me more about your faith in the United States or the president of the United States. What if we humbled ourselves enough to take our own identities out of it and have the courage to see a different hue of the truth, the view from a different perspective? What if we, instead of turning our backs or closing our laptops or rolling our eyes, learn to live deliberately, as Thoreau encouraged us, to learn what life has to teach, to live deep and suck out the marrow of life, to cut a broad swath, to drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms. In the Zen tradition, they tell the story of a man, an important man, who came to visit the Zen master. I have come today to ask you to teach me about Zen, the man said. Open my mind to enlightenment. The tone of the man's voice signified that he was accustomed to obedience from others. The Zen master smiled and said that they should discuss the matter over a cup of tea. When the tea was served, the master poured his visitor a cup. He poured and he poured, and the tea rose to the rim and began to spill over the table and finally onto the robes of the wealthy man. And finally he shouted, enough! You are spilling the tea all over! Can't you see the cup is full? The master stopped pouring and smiled at his guest. You are like this teacup, so full that nothing more can be added. Come back to me when the cup is empty. Come back to me with an empty mind. How interesting that when someone lacks humility, we say they are full of themselves. Something else I've learned about humility is that it goes both ways. The individual sharing a personal story must, like a scientist, be aware of biases that might serve as obstructions. This is where identity is a double-edged sword. It is valuable and beautiful to identify with a particular group of people, LGBTQ, a Republican, a Black American, as long as we never forget that those outside of our self-defined groups experience life differently. We all see the world through lenses of age, ethnicity, race, ability, says the writer and sociologist Brené Brown. And then we slide in a lot of other lenses, like insight, personal experience, history, family stories. The wider, more Judeo-Christian, straighter, middle class, and more educated we are, the more likely we are to be told that the lens we use to see the world is actually the world. And how other people see the world is another unreal version of the world. We tell people that empathy is putting down that lens and picking up the lens of another person, but we can't put down the lens. The lens is soldered to our face. If we own our story, she concludes, then we get to write the ending. If we don't own our stories own us. But how do we relate and connect in a world where everyone has a different lens? The answer, she says, is you believe people's stories. You believe people's experiences as they tell them to you. You believe that the world they see through their lens is as real and honest and truthful as the world that we see through our lens. It's okay to have an opinion, but you can't dismiss what people experience and talk about as truth. When I show up at a scientist's or an engineer's office with as humble a mind as possible, as empty a mind as possible, beautiful things begin to happen. Once I make him or her feel comfortable with the idea, the person I'm deeply listening to blossoms under the attention. Finally, someone is listening to them. Someone finds them interesting and even noteworthy. Life has, for one short hour, become a little less lonely. The person across from me feels a little more connected, a little more needed. And this is why I am now convinced that humility must play a central role in activism and political resistance. As the great political theorist Hannah Arendt taught us after she experienced the horrors of World War II, holding space for someone else's story is a powerful political act. Terror, she wrote, can rule absolutely only over people who are isolated against each other. Therefore, one of the primary concerns of all tyrannical government is to bring this isolation about. Isolation may be the beginning of terror. It certainly is its most fertile ground. It always is its result. Power always comes from people acting together. Isolated people are powerless by definition. His Holiness the Dalai Lama also addressed the plague of isolation and loneliness that we currently face in his recent New York Times essay. He cited an experiment in which researchers found that senior citizens who didn't feel useful to others were nearly 3 times as likely to die prematurely as those who did feel useful. Being needed, says His Holiness, does not entail selfish pride or unhealthy attachment to the worldly esteem of others. Rather, it consists of a natural human hunger to serve our fellow men and women. Feeling superfluous is a blow to the human spirit. It leads to social isolation and emotional pain and creates the condition for negative emotions to take root. How many of our fellow Americans feel superfluous? And how will we know unless we stop to listen to them? I believe it is through humility, through a methodical dedication to finding out as many answers as possible to the unanswerable questions that make us human, that we can begin to devise solutions for all the problems humans face. But how do we begin? How do we build a practice of humility into our lives? My answer is to think of humility as a scientific method for loving other human beings. The scientific way of thinking, Carl Sagan writes, is at once imaginative and disciplined. This is central to its success. Science, like humility, invites us to let facts in even when they don't conform to our preconceptions. Science, like humility, counsels us to carry alternative hypotheses in our heads and see which best fits the facts. Science, like humility, urges on us a delicate balance between no holds barred openness to new ideas, however heretical, and the most rigorous, skeptical scrutiny of everything, new ideas and established wisdom. This kind of thinking is also an essential tool, he writes, for a democracy in an age of change. And it's been my experience that once you stop to contemplate humility and its role in the world, you see it happening all around you. Here's what humility looks like in the wild. Humility is keeping your identity small and noticing what topics make it scramble to loom large. Humility is knowing the difference between believing in yourself and believing only in yourself. Humility is choosing an issue you find complicated. Immigration, abortion, education, grappling with it, and even considering changing your mind. Humility is reaching out to someone who is nothing like you simply because they are nothing like you. Humility is taking fewer selfies and more groupies. Humility is giving credit where credit is due, even if it means admitting a fool is sometimes correct. Humility is saying, tell me more, instead of, you're wrong and I can't listen to that. Humility is knowing that you won't be perfect at reaching out to others and knowing that some people will use your imperfection as a weapon to lash out at you, but humility is persisting anyway. And humility, says the Dalai Lama, is starting each day by, quote, consciously asking ourselves, what can I do today to appreciate the gifts that others offer me? Notice he did not say, what can others do to appreciate the gifts I have to offer? Humility is, of course, also realizing that there are limits to what each of us has to offer, that there are limits to what we understand. Carl Sagan has something to say about this, too. Humans may crave absolute certainty. They may aspire to it. They may pretend, as partisans of certain religions do, to have attained it. But the history of science, by far the most successful claim to knowledge accessible to humans, teaches that the most we can hope for is successive improvement in our understanding, learning from our mistakes, an asymptotic approach to the universe, but with the proviso that absolute certainty will always elude us. We will always be mired in error. The most each generation can hope for is to reduce the error bars a little and add to the body of data to which the error bars apply. We must, in other words, learn to recognize when we are holding on too tightly to the lenses we use to see the world, and be willing to let go lightly of what might not be entirely true. We must call the bluff of those who only pretend to knowledge, especially when the ones doing the pretending are ourselves. It is in this way that humility can become a balm for humans whose arrogance causes so much trouble in the world. To remind us that not even the light of the sun is guaranteed as long as there is a moon in the sky. Nothing is certain. No one has a monopoly on the truth. All we have is one another, a lot of unanswerable questions, and those three words that might very well save civilization as we know it. Tell me more.